Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia.
That's the wonderful Dara Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, who wrote the words to that song, except for one. And you know what that is. It's Solartopia. Harvey Sluggo Washerman here for another hour at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thanks to the crew in New York, and thank you, H. Bruce Franklin, for joining us today. We got a full hour, which can't even begin to cover your incredibly diverse and fascinating and very, very impressive life here. Bruce, you have, well, let me tell you first, folks, Bruce Franklin and I actually met in Paris in 1967. Bruce, do you remember being in Paris in 1967?
Yes, that's what it was.
It was pretty amazing. We were staying at the world-famous Shakespeare. I was staying at the world-famous Shakespeare and Company bookstore, which is still there. It was run at the time by a wonderful guy named George Whitman, who allowed, if you showed up at Shakespeare and Company, which was a literary monument in its own self, and if you were young and you showed up and you said that you were a writer, George would put you up for a week, put you on the couch there, which I slept on for a week, and watched wonderful people come through with great leftist and culturally diverse ideas, and one of them was H. Bruce Franklin, and I just contacted Bruce a while ago, and he sent me his fantastic book here, which we're going to talk about, Crash Course, the Good War, From the Good War to the Forever War. A terrific book, says Daniel Ellsberg, and it's published by the Rutgers University Press. And it is a really fantastic piece of work, Bruce. We want to talk about you in particular in a little bit, but tell us about this book, Crash Course. Tell us what's in it and how it came about and all that stuff.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me here, Harvey. Great to be talking with you again. Well, it's an attempt to use history to figure out how we get out of the fix we're in. So we have to figure, what is the fix we're in? Well, we humans have defined ourselves as Homo sapiens. You know, we're the smartest creatures ever. So we're so smart that we've been able to figure out a means to exterminate our species, of course, nuclear weapons. Not only we figured out a way to do it, but we actually have built the doomsday machine. And so we live every day under that threat. And so one of our motives in doing this book, which is part memoir, was to bring in my own experience flying in the Strategic Air Command, and what I learned.
Wait, Bruce. Let's repeat that. You, who are one of the great leaders of the peace movement, and very, very well known and very well respected, and you have been active for since the beginning of time. But you casually mentioned that you were in the Strategic Air Command, which I found actually one of the most fascinating pieces in your book. I mean, here we are reading a book from a guy who was fired by Stanford for leading peace demonstrations, has had a tremendous career in the peace movement, you and your wife, and you flew in the Strategic Air Command with nuclear weapons in your belly. Tell us about that. That's astounding to me. And it was astounding to read about, and you had some really detailed and very hair-raising experiences in the Strategic Air Command. So let me introduce you.
Well, I was
a
navigator, an intelligence officer in mid-air refueling, refueling the bombers that were routinely flying over the Soviet Union. People don't understand the dangers that we're in. Three times when I was in, we launched, not practice, but launched, full launch, directed at the Soviet Union, and were recalled with minutes to spare. Now, part of my understanding and of consciousness, you know, I was raised in World War II, I'm a loyal American, was that not for a second did it ever occur to me, should I be doing this? And that's the mindset of all the people now who are in command and control. And the dangers that we face then are much smaller than the dangers we're facing now. And we have an administration right now that's doing everything in its power to make that danger worse. We're destroying the structure that we were in the process of building to protect us from this. We have now devastated the non-proliferation treaty, which is what we're doing with our offensive against Iran. We are not living up to our responsibilities to that treaty, which means that we are supposed to be in the process of disarming and helping countries that don't have nuclear power. If they want it, we're supposed to help them get it. So that's just one of the existential threats that we're facing. The other one, everybody knows about this one, of course, is that, again, here we are, Homo sapiens. We're in the process of destroying the environment that made our species possible, made it possible for our species to thrive. And again, we have a government which is doing everything in its power to accelerate and increase the danger to our environment, in bed with fossil fuels, actively pushing coal, in bed, of course, with the so-called defense industry. So that's the fix we're in. And our main motive in writing this book was to say, well, if you're in a situation like that, a very dangerous situation, let's say you find yourself in the middle of a forest surrounded by dangers, how are you going to get out of it? You can't get out of it unless you know how you got into it, which means that you have to understand the history. And the history that I'm dealing with in the book is the history of World War II, how we lost World War II to the forces that we were supposedly fighting, the way our consciousness after that war was manipulated to create the so-called Cold War, which wasn't really so cold after all, and then taking that story all the way up through the present, you know, through my experience not only in the Air Force but also working on the waterfront in New York, etc., taking it up through my life as an activist, when I've been an activist for peace and justice for, I guess, pretty close to, 60 years, I guess, counting, to the impasse that we are, and understand how our consciousness is formed by this history, and how we have to understand both the history and our own consciousness. You know, I think that everybody, pretty much, who's born as an American and raised in our culture has internalized the belief that it's our mission somehow to run the world, provide leadership in the world, and then that running up against the obvious contradictions in our behavior as the most dangerous empire that's ever been on this planet.
Well, let me ask you, Bruce. You said that for most of your life, or for the early part of your life, you never questioned what was going on with our military establishment and our culture and all that stuff. What was the moment that when you did question it, and what was the what caused you first, that magic moment, to question what was going on?
Okay, well, you know, I was brought up in World War II. I was, for American experience, I was 7 when America got into it, and 11 when we got out of it. So, you know, I of course believe we were the good guys fighting for democracy and peace and so forth. And then somehow the yellow octopus, that's Japan, was suddenly transformed into the red octopus, the communist threat. So when I went into the Air Force, I believe I was, you know, there to protect the world from the communist menace. And I believe that the United States was under the threat of a nuclear attack from the Soviet Union at any moment. It wasn't one moment, Harvey. It was because I don't think that's how consciousness works. You know, it's just running into contradictions after contradictions, having it forced into my consciousness that there was no Soviet threat. They had no means to attack us. Then that led to, on some level, an understanding that our government was systematically lying to us. Then there were all kinds of things that I do develop in that chapter about the Air Force, all kinds of other things that I was realizing about the nature of the planes and how they were built and what the purpose was and so forth. And I think this, what happened to me happened to millions of people. That is, there were all these contradictions, but what's inside one's head is just pretty much a jumble of contradictions anyhow. So I couldn't really make sense out of this until I started getting active against the Vietnam War, and that's what happened to millions of people, because the Vietnam War and the lies about the war and the lies about the history changed consciousness radically, and then I could understand so much about my private experience, again, not only in the Air Force, but also in the other jobs that I had before that, like working on the waterfront. Discovering, for instance, about that during World War II, the United States made a formal contract with the mob that they would run the New York waterfront. This is not the picture you get from that horrible movie On the Waterfront. So you know, everything in consciousness changed because of participation in the activism against the war, which I must say that, you know, Greta Thunberg, a very inspirational person, and I just read something day before yesterday. You know, she was in deep depression, and her activism has taken her out of depression. So I think probably a lot of people listening to this show are in some kind of depression or on the verge of depression about the situation that we're in. And one of the best things you can do about depression is go out and get active and do something to change the situation. That's something that we learned in that movement, that wonderful movement of American people against the Vietnam War.
Yeah, and you know, the number one way to fight depression is to have purpose. And, you know, we do. One thing you can say for Donald Trump is he has given us purpose. Although most of us had it, many of us had it before, but he's really up the level. We're talking with H. Bruce Franklin, author of The Crash Course from the Good War to the Forever War. Bruce, you have an incredible list of interests and publications, and you have an abiding interest and have done substantial writing on science fiction. We'll come back to the politics of the situation. You went to Amherst College, and then after that, where did you go?
Well, after college, I worked on tugs in New York Harbor, and then I was in the Air Force.
Oh, wait, you jumped over that. You worked in the New York Harbor. What did you do in the New York Harbor?
Well, the first jobs I had there were actually working in a factory, a sweatshop, on the waterfront. Then I was a mate and then on Pennsylvania Railroad tugboats working on the harbor. And it was during the actual war that was being waged. I mean, that's not just a metaphor. That was a war, and that was a moment of where I could put my finger on change of consciousness, because I was standing on the old lines, the ropes on the bow of the tugboat, about to toss a line. And I noticed, looked like a man's shirt in the water. And then I realized it wasn't just a shirt, it was a body. So I signaled to the captain to reverse. And when he did, the whole body came up. We took the body out. And he had a bag hook in the back of the neck. A bag hook was what longshoremen used to handle the big bags of merchandise. And the bag hook was a sign that this is a mob killing. This is a longshoreman had been killed by one of the mob factions that were warring on the waterfront. So that certainly made an impression on me.
Did you know the guy?
No, of course not. I did know Johnny Delgilio, who was a major hitman for the mob. We actually sparred for once on a dock. He took it easy, of course.
Wow! So I assume you've seen The Irishman, and it rang true to you.
Well, yeah, yes and no. There's some things. I think a couple of things. One, I think it's unfortunate that in this period, when organized labor has been largely smashed by this capitalist state, to have a portrayal of Jimmy Hoffa and the Teamsters where the main thing that you're looking at is the role of the mob, because Jimmy Hoffa didn't start out like that, and he was a leader who built the most powerful union in America and did it in the face of fierce fighting from the powers that be in our society, the major corporations and their henchmen in the government. So it's unfortunate that that's the view we get. And there are other distortions, historical distortions in the movie. On the other hand, I think that the end of the movie is very, very powerful. And it does give a sense, maybe you have to bring something to the movie to really get this, the interrelationship between organized crime and the government, what's behind our Cuba policy then and now, what was the Bay of Pigs all about, you know, et cetera. And that's, you know, the as Russell says in the movie, if they can whack the president, they can whack the head of the Teamsters. So they start flowing through that movie.
Well, that's one of the reasons the Godfather movie, especially the second one, is so important as a historical document, because it shows how the mob really owned and operated Cuba. And, when Fidel overthrew them, the government then came in on the side of the mob to take back the casinos. And, of course, it failed, and that's one of the reasons that John Kennedy was killed. We're talking with H. Bruce Franklin, author of Crash Course and about 19 other books, I assume. I read that you've either written or edited. And so you had first experience. I mean, you came from a working-class background. You didn't grow up in an academic family, so you worked on the docks, and then you were actually a navigator in the Strategic Air Command. I mean, that's astounding. Well, of course, Dan Ellsberg, your neighbor in Berkeley, also was in the military, but he was a think tank guy. And I always repeat this story as much as possible. Dan Ellsberg, in one of his many writings, mentioned that he was in the Oval Office with Nixon as a military advisor. And Nixon told him that, and this is before Dan became, leaked the Pentagon Papers and became an icon of the anti-war left. At this point, he was a supporter of the Vietnam War. And Nixon told him that had it not been for the movement against the war in Vietnam, had it not been for the demonstrations and all that, that he would have used nuclear weapons in Vietnam. So those of us who were active in the movement against the war in Vietnam can take great pride in knowing that our demonstrations prevented this madman in the White House from using nuclear weapons in Vietnam. And I'm sure you've talked to Dan about that, Bruce.
Lots.
And it's I actually invited Dan. I love Dan, and I wanted to have lunch with him anyway, but I was staying in Berkeley, and I invited him and Peter Dale Scott to lunch specifically to ask Dan if that was true. And he said absolutely yes, that Nixon really would have used nuclear weapons in Vietnam had it been for us scruffy hippies marching through the streets, which he said never affected anything he did. But, of course, we know we saw his real response at Kent State. So that's a true story. I'm really curious.
About the anti-war movement, I think it's absolutely right, and I was down for a minute Dan's reporting on that. But eventually what was the real cutting edge of the anti-war movement, what made it so effective, was the movement inside the military and also the deserter movement. And here again, I tried to get into the book some of my experience in that, because that year that you and I met in Paris in 67, I was there 66, 67 in France, I was working with the Vietnamese, and also helping to set up the deserter network, which is a major, largely untold story about the way the anti-war movement actually made it impossible for the ground army to function in an effective way, and why they had to then depend more and more on air power, especially naval air power, which led to, and there's a lot of stuff about that in my own personal involvement, a revolutionary movement on every single aircraft carrier at Yankee Station. The aircraft carriers that were launching the attacks on Vietnam. Every one had a revolutionary newspaper being published on board the ship, and then the ships had to be brought back with all the intended vegetables. So in San Diego, the men of that fleet were organizing a fleet-wide revolutionary movement. And the only reason that I am not in prison now was because I was there in San Diego speaking to the sailors and had all these witnesses where it was, while the FBI was framing me for a crime I was supposedly committing many hundreds of miles away from that. So that's, but it is the movement inside the military that ultimately made it impossible for the U.S. government to continue this war, including, and this, I guess, was the part was unbelievable, that it even penetrating my alma mater, the Strategic Air Command, when you had planes, crews of planes, the bombers, refusing to fly their missions. That was when it became, the handwriting was on the wall that the administration had to end that war, or there would be they could be heading into a real revolutionary movement.
That's amazing. It's an amazing story, the resistance, and undertold. That's one of the main critiques of Ken Burns's Vietnam series, which I watched from beginning to end. Is there's really not a whole lot devoted to the resistance within the military, which is more than the nervous systems of most mainstream, certainly conservative Americans can handle. Is this idea that the American military itself was the hotbed, or the most important, as you say, most important hotbed of resistance to the Vietnam War. Now, we have seen it in other instances. There was revolution during the Revolutionary War. There was mutiny during the Mexican War. There was tremendous opposition during the World War One. There was enormous opposition to World War One. It was the American presence in World War One was very brief, and had it gone on longer, it was not sustainable in any way, shape, or form. Some in World War II, but and maybe some in Korea, but in Vietnam it became a definitive force. There was also, during the Civil War, of course, there was enormous resistance in both the North and the South. I mean, the Confederate Army basically fell apart from desertion. So there is a tremendous history of this, and you, Bruce, during the Vietnam War, were right in the middle of it. Really fascinating to read. And to understand your experiences there. And I'm sure there's plenty of it going on in Iraq and Afghanistan as well that we don't hear about.
That's certainly true. The other reason that I'm kind of terrified about the present moment, and again, this takes us to another part of history, connecting some dots, is some stuff that I'm researching now has taken me into the history of Germany in 1931 to 1933. And it's really terrifying because you have exactly the same personality as our president today. I read today the latest poll that 55% of American people want Trump to be removed from office. His support is 41%. 41% is actually the peak of Hitler's popularity and representation in the Reichstag, exactly the same figure. And he was losing seats when he bullied the main corporate entities, especially IG Farben, to bankroll his seizure of power. So, to me, the seminaries are very scary because they've made it abundantly clear that if they win in November, they're going to lock it down. They will have the Supreme Court. They will have the judiciary in general. Voter suppression will have no limits at all. And so they will have complete control of the electoral system, which is very scary indeed. Because, you know, Germany was a small landlocked, almost landlocked country in the middle of Europe. Once they went that to the dark side, they were able to build a military colossus so powerful that it took the combined efforts of the Soviet Union and the United States to defeat it. If the same forces take over the United States of America this year, what force in the world would be able to reverse that or to protect our planet and our species from the threats that we're facing? That's very scary.
Well, especially when you consider that the United States, if it's Trump, will be aligned with Russia. Putin basically is a mob boss who owns Donald Trump. As we've talked about on the show, Trump was bankrupt in the 1980s, but he did have real estate, and he used his real estate to launder billions of rubles into the American economy. And these mob bosses, and then in 99, Putin took over the mob bosses and the mob in Russia and took over Trump. I mean, Trump became an asset of Putin. As people talk about collusion, collusion is a vast understatement. Donald Trump is just flat out owned outright by Vladimir Putin. And so, you know, with his insanity at the top, linked to Putin, you've got two basically fascist dictatorships. I mean, it's just, we are really facing it. You're 100% right. We're talking with H. Bruce Franklin, author of Crash Course and 19 or 20 other books that he's written or edited. And your experiences are just truly astounding. Tell us a bit, if you would, about your fascination and your writings in science fiction. Noam Chomsky has complimented your work in science fiction. What is your attraction to science fiction, and what is the message you want to convey in your writings about science fiction? You've written about Star Trek, Star Wars.
That's a huge topic. I actually get into it a little bit in Crash Course, because I went to the 1939 World's Fair, and it had a tremendous impact on my imagination. This was the world of the future, and that's haunted me. And I, you know, was really into science fiction. And I realized that trying to understand American consciousness, and, you know, what I spoke at the beginning about Homo sapiens constructing the means of our extermination, that's a little unfair to the whole species, because it was really our country and our culture that was the basis for actually developing this weapon, using it, and on two cities, wiping out most of the population of two cities. And so it was really into science fiction that I plunged to understand this, which eventuated in what I consider my most important book, actually, which is called War Stars, the Super Weapon in the American Imagination, where I show, beginning in the 18th century with Robert Fulton, and going through a lot of 19th century science fiction, a lot of 20th century science fiction, how this consciousness became something that dominated the culture of our society. So it's not a separate subject at all. It's a very related subject, which I just touch upon briefly in credit. Well, no, not so briefly, because I have a pretty long chapter about nuclear weapons and trace some of those collections. Could you collect some of those dots in Crash Course?
Well, how would you characterize the core of what you're trying to say about science fiction? Are you saying that it has, well, tell us exactly how you think science fiction has affected the human mindset and the American mindset. What is the core problem here?
Well, as like everything else, it's made of contradictions. I guess here's an easy way to put your finger on it. At the height of the consciousness of the war in Vietnam and the growing new movement in 1968, some science fiction writers decided to give a petition of science fiction writers who would be opposed to the Vietnam War, and they thought that all science fiction writers would all be against the war. But that sparked a counter-movement. And so in 1668, if you picked up a science fiction magazine, you were facing pages signers of the petition against the war and signers of the petition for the war. If you look at those names, those two lists, you understand the contradictions in science fiction, which, of course, they're not really separate from the other cultural contradictions, but they have an enormous impact. So, for example, the signers, some of the signers of the pro-war, pro-Vietnam War, were the people who went to Ronald Reagan and convinced him about the so-called Strategic Defense Initiative, otherwise known as Star Wars. So the cover of my book War Stars is a picture released by the Defense Department of beam weapons in space shooting at the planet. It's a science fiction cover, but it was developed by a picture of promoting Star Wars in the culture in order to do what? Well, of course, make enormous profits for the so-called defense industry. But you see that, you know, what we call the dark side of science fiction working directly on creating more of the problem that we're facing, the existential problem of our own annihilation. Because everything they've done has increased the danger that we're facing from these weapons. And if you do, you have to, I think, understand the role of science fiction in that, in propagating it and opposing it. Because if there are other science fiction, great science fiction is a very different vision of our future possibilities, and also, of course, of dystopian visions that flow directly from.
Well, who were the anti-war writers that you would recommend, and that you can clarify for us? Bruce?
Yeah.
Can you hear me? Who were the anti-war science fiction writers?
Let me just see if I can find the picture.
I mean, I would assume Ursula Le Guin.
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah, she was certainly one. And in fact, well, here's again another way to say the docs. You picked a very good one. Avatar which is was truly a major anti-imperialist movie.
Absolutely.
Which was deprived of the Oscar by a very well-organized movement against it, and given
right.
to that piece of trash, I haven't even mentioned the name, which was a
Hurt Locker.
War movie. But Avatar was basically based on Ursula K. Le Guin's The Word for World is Forest, which is people who are familiar with that will recognize how much Avatar leans on that. And so that's, you know, right there as a major work of our cultural imagination.
Yeah, and I actually was on a panel with Jim Cameron, you know, it was great, and he was a great someone to know, and Avatar is one of my favorite movies of all time. I actually almost got thrown out of the theater when I saw Avatar, because at the end there, and I'm sure most people have seen it, when the bad guy is done in, I started yelling and clapping, and I was the only one in the whole theater, and it was not a comfortable moment for my daughter, who was sitting next to me. But there you go. I think Avatar is one of the great movies of all time. And
it was a right-wing movement that was organized against it, and a lot of the left fell for it, because the right-wing movement criticized the movie from a left-wing point of view. Say you always have the white superhero, blah, blah, blah. But, of course, the white superhero is not the one who wins that macho, mano-a-mano fight. It's the native woman who kills the bad guy. Right? But, okay, another writer who I really recommend very strongly is Kim Stanley Robinson. I don't know if you know his work. But,
no.
He's a major science fiction writer who extrapolates a lot of things that we've thought about, like colonizing Mars. And he has a Mars trilogy, which is three long novels, which looks at what would be involved from a basically Marxist point of view. And is that
Groucho or Carl? Sorry. Dan from there.
Carl.
And of course, you know, the ultimate piece of dystopian, I don't know if you'd call it science fiction, but dystopian fiction is 1984 by the great George Orwell, who was as great a writer as we've ever had. And where would Ray Bradbury have come down on the war? You know, Fahrenheit 451 and the other great works he wrote. Was he part of the anti-war movement?
Well, Bradbury is basically a romantic who a lot of his work is running against the sort of main flow of a lot of science fiction. So it would be interesting to compare Bradbury's vision of Mars with Kim Stanley Robinson's vision of Mars.
Well, let me ask you the ultimate question, which I'm sure anyone who's interested in science fiction and the politics of it is going to ask you. How do you evaluate Star Wars and Star Trek? Where do you see these two coming down in the political pantheon?
Well, I think Star Wars is, when you get right down to it, pretty reactionary. Star Trek, I've written about extensively. They wanted to do the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum wanted to do an exhibit on Star Trek, and they asked me to come down to critique their proposal and then to come down and meet with them. So I came down and meet with them, and I proposed that instead of just having, you know, sort of this fan-based view of Star Trek, that they have an exhibit called Star Trek in the 60s. So I was the guest curator for that exhibit, which was the most popular exhibit that the Air and Space Museum of the Smithsonian has ever had, and I wrote a lot about that. I wrote a lot of the what they call the text that you see in, you know, for the exhibits, and you know Star Trek, and one of the astonishing things about Star Trek is a very brief history, you know, but I read about it in great detail. You can see its transformation about the Vietnam War in the course of its brief history, from beginning as saying, "Well, you know, it's too bad, but it's sort of necessary," to outright opposition, and to a vision of American society, which was very dark at the end. A lot of this is we're talking about science fiction, talking a lot about the future, imagining futures. I do want to get back to the history because what we're dealing with now is has to do with the past. Where our government and our and a lot of the culture is now controlled by a literally reactionary vision of history. You know, make America great again. Trump did not create this. It's been there. And if you look in American history, you see these basic contradictions going all the way back to 1619. Again, I hate to be dealing in horror stories, but the most similar moment in the contest between these forces in American history is the post-Reconstruction period, which was, you know, an out-and-out reactionary period, very, very similar to what's going on today. We had a vision of America, of the future of America, being enacted in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment to the Constitution. And then, you know, the abolition of slavery, giving the vote to black people, black men, not black women, or white women. And then this ferocious, extremely powerful movement that reversed much of the achievements of Reconstruction and created a reign of terror for black people, not just in the South. I mean, New Jersey had lots of lynchings. New Jersey is not a southern state. These are the forces that you see at those Trump rallies.
Right.
In my mind, I see the connection, you know, to American history, you know, back to post Reconstruction, but I also see it, as I mentioned before, to what happened in Germany, 1931 to 1933.
Right, and of course the reaction to the civil rights movement of the 1960s was, of course, the drug war. The drug war, which really was like the Klan after the Civil War, 41 million people arrested, mostly for pot, and mostly, you know, blacks and Hispanics. And that was Nixon's revenge and counter-revolution against the civil rights movement of the 1960s, was to use the drug war to disenfranchise you know, the black community and the Hispanic community, and prevent, and of course the counterculture, and to prevent the forces of peace and justice from taking power.
Well, I mean, what you're saying, Harvey, is very, very true. And mass incarceration was not something that just, you know, fell out of the sky. It was a strategy to reverse the civil rights movement, to take the vote away from black people, brown people, poor people in general. But you know, the real target was people of color, and it was very, very successful. I mean, you look at Florida, and how the disenfranchisement of what, something like 40% of the black population in Florida, if that hadn't happened, think of all the elections that would have gone, national elections that would have gone the other way. And, you know, again, felony disenfranchisement was something that was devised when, precisely in that post-Reconstruction period, because the 15th Amendment, which forbid taking the vote away from people because of race or color, did not forbid other things. So they came up with a lot of things like, you know, poll tax, literacy test. A white guy would administer a literary test to potential black voters, say, "Well, you didn't understand this well enough, so you can't vote." And we have a documentary record that the people who proposed felony disenfranchisement said they think that the other ways of disenfranchising voters would eventually be struck down, but felony disenfranchisement would stand. If you start thinking about the people who have been deprived of their vote, we're talking about, I think, close to 4 million people by felony disenfranchisement. And imagine them voting. We wouldn't have a Senate of the Republican side of basically
right. And
with
now,
the white
now,
guys.
Of course, obviously, the number one agenda item for the Republicans and the Trump is to strip the voter rolls, you know, allegedly for not voting and this and that. And they're doing it in the key states, and that's the number one agenda item for Trump to win a second term. I never say re-election because he wasn't election much in the first place. We're almost out of time. Bruce Franklin, how do people get a hold of you?
Oh, good question. I have a homepage, which is just my name, hbrucefranklin, one word, .com. You go there, and my email address is public. I am active on Facebook also. So it's on my homepage is a lot of stuff about my other rights as well as Crash Course.
Well, you're a tremendous. I mean, we could talk for another couple hours here, and I want to thank PRN for having you on. And Bruce, your current book is Crash Course from the Good War to the Forever War. What is the key now to saving the earth and our society from this latest incarnation of Adolf Hitler? How do we, you know, and I don't mince any words. Some people say, oh, you'll turn people off if you refer to Trump as Hitler. I mean, there's no doubt he's Hitler. He's the American Hitler. He's exactly what you would expect from the fascist movement in this country. How do we stop him, Bruce Franklin? What do we do?
Well, the only way we can do it is with the electoral process. Unfortunately, that's all we have. So that means, I think, that we have a lot of work cut out for us. I think it's not just Trump; it's the Senate. I mean, people in Southern California ought to hook up with people in Arizona and flip that Senate seat that can be flipped there. I know the last election, people from California went out to Arizona and helped out. You know, I live in the Bay Area, and it was kind of a cocoon. The real battlegrounds are elsewhere, but there's lots of ways that you can write, you can participate in phoning, you can contribute, whatever it takes. And, we don't know who the opposing candidate is going to be, and I think that the people who talk about, I'm not going to vote for the lesser evil, are really very confused, because that's not a logical analysis of lesser evil. It's a question of stopping this process and reversing the process. We are not going to be able to elect a president or a Congress that is magically going to change the United States of America into something which is not an empire. That's down the road.
The key word.
But if we lose the election in November, I don't think we're going to get another chance, because they're going to lock it down. It's that simple.
I think you're 100% right, and but we also got to have a decent candidate. I don't see Joe Biden becoming president of the United States. I don't see it happening. I mean, Bernie is a stretch, but he has certainly, he won't go away. You're starting to see a concession now in the mainstream liberal media, especially the New York Times. They're starting to understand that his constituency, Bernie's, like Trump's, is not going to go away. And sooner or later, the principles that Bernie is putting forward, which are being somewhat adopted by Elizabeth Warren, are going to have to take hold. I mean, you know, we have a problem here. That's the end. That's the problem. Bruce Franklin, you are fantastic. We'll have to have you back on.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Harvey. Thank you. Go to his website, and we'll see you next week in Solartopia.
When the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know we're gonna